Mornings are better with a warm beverage, even for Latter-day Saints. Meet Postum, the ideal coffee alternative and proud sponsor of This Week in Mormons podcast. Spot it on the coffee aisle at Smith's Grocery or at your local nearby store. Can't locate it? No worries. Order it at Postum.com. Explore delicious recipes to tailor your Postum experience. Start your day off right with Postum.
Welcome, everybody, to This Week in Mormons with the twin siblings, Matt and Melissa. How are you doing, Melissa?
I'm great. Whenever you introduce yourself as Matt, I feel uncomfortable because I call you Maddie. Don't you like Maddie better?
No. So when we were kids, I was okay with Maddie, but now I'm an adult. And so I kind of prefer Matt or Matthew. But
okay, Matt. Well, yeah, it's good to be here. We have a great guest today.
Yeah, we have with us Mike. Do you want to introduce yourself? I'd rather let you introduce yourself.
I feel like I'm the third M here. I'm Mike Benson, all the way from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and really happy to be with you. So thank you very much for the invitation.
So Mike Benson right now is president of Coastal Carolina University and got some pioneer heritage. What is it? Where do you want to start with getting to know you and what you're up to?
So I'm the, I'll start with my family. I'm the youngest of six children. My older brother, people probably know Steve by reputation, the cartoonist, who's down in Arizona, won a Pulitzer Prize years ago. But he is in Arizona with his wife and their children. And then I have four sisters. They're all over. One's on a mission in Korea. The other two in Utah. One tragically was killed in a car accident about 18 months ago, my oldest sister. So both my parents have passed on, but you never, when you have a death in the family like that, which doesn't give you any time to prepare, that's really hard. So we're still reeling from that. But she was an amazing sister and mom, eight kids, 25 grandchildren. And now that day goes by, I don't think about Stephanie. And then we've been here in South Carolina. You know, I spent kind of the formative years of my life in Texas, in Dallas. My dad was a mission president in Indiana when I was 7 years old. And then I graduated high school in Utah at East High, home of High School Musical.
Yeah.
Yes, we're all in this together. Yeah, do you know the dance? Can you do the dance?
Yeah, but I won't do it.
Oh, okay, but you can. I knew you could. I knew it.
And then I went to BYU. The two things at BYU that really, I think, put me on my path where I am today. One was I did an internship, part of Washington Seminar, and really fell in love with that experience. And then after that, directly after that semester in D.C., I did 6 months in Israel at the Jerusalem Center. And, you know, to that point, I was thinking about law school. And then I called my parents one day from Jerusalem. And I remember telling them, you know, Mom and Dad, this is what I want to do. I want to do Middle Eastern history. And there was a long pause on the phone. And it wasn't because it was a bad connection. And my dad said, okay, what are you going to do with that? and I said, I don't know. I really don't. But my parents, to their credit, were big believers in allowing their children the latitude to choose what they wanted to do. I mean, among my sisters, I have amazing musicians. My brother's an artist. And that led me to, I took a year off and then went to grad school over in England. I went to Oxford and did a doctorate in history there. And then got right into kind of college work. My first job was at the University of Utah. Raising money. And then I went to work for a guy named Bernie Matchin, who became he was the president. He had come from Michigan as the provost. And then after his time in Utah, went to Florida, where he was president for 15 years. And Bernie's top of mind right now because yesterday was his 80th birthday. And they called me and asked me to do a little snippet, you know, birthday greeting. And I owe him a lot. I mean, I'm a big believer that, you know, people are the ones that give you opportunities, and you're kind of, I believe, obligated to give those same opportunities or kinds of opportunities to others. So I owe Bernie a great deal. And I told him that in this video, and he wrote me a really nice email back. And I have him to thank for a lot of my professional track or trajectory. So I'll end here in terms of about me. Was at the University of Utah, became president of Snow College when I was 36, very young. I think I had a lot of on-the-job training. I had one faculty member when I first got there. He came in my office. He said, He called me Benson. He said, just so you know, Benson, the year you were born is when I got tenure here. So, so he kind of put me in my place. And, you know, from there, I went to Southern Utah. I was president of Southern Utah for almost, 7 years. Then we had a chance to go to Kentucky. Really enjoyed our time in Central Kentucky. And then took a year off. I was on the faculty at Johns Hopkins for a year in Baltimore and wrote a book about the first president of Johns Hopkins. And then that led to our opportunity here at Coastal. And 5 children. First off, my wife, Debbie, she turns 50 this week. And my best friend, and we've been married for 18 years now. I have 2 older children from a first marriage. Emma is a TV reporter for KSL in Salt Lake. Samuel is the national correspondent for the Deseret News covering the presidential election. So
He
travels the country as a political scientist. Matt, I know you'll appreciate that.
Yeah.
He was out here for the South Carolina primary. And then our 3 T's, that's what we call them, Truman, Tatum, and Talmadge. And those are 17, 16, well, almost 16, and 13. And they keep us awfully busy. So in a nutshell, that's who I am.
You have opened the door to so many questions that we now have for you. Where do you want to start, Melissa?
Well, first of all, so what are Truman, Tatum, and Talmadge? They have a lot to live up to. I mean, it sounds like your family really accomplishes a lot. I mean, me and Matt come from a family of 7 siblings, and I don't ever say things like we did this amazing thing and that amazing thing. I really don't. No offense to our siblings, but you yourself also. I mean, you've accomplished so many big things. Like how does that work as a parent? Like I know you said your parents let you explore whatever you want. Are you that kind of a parent too?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, there are a lot of things that my parents did that we've tried to emulate. Some not so much. my parents were incredibly strict. And we've tried to give a little more latitude to our kids, but I owe so much to my mom and dad. I mean, they sacrificed for us things they never dreamed. I mean, that I got to go to graduate school in England or I got to do study abroad. I mean, my mother was raised in a really humble little town in Southern Alberta, Raymond, Alberta, Canada, and met my dad at BYU. And so as I said, both parents have passed away, and every day I try to do right by them and train our kids to be grateful, not have any sort of sense of entitlement or privilege, but recognize that in life we have opportunities and we've got to do the best we can with those opportunities. So, my kids, Truman, his middle name is Taft, just like mine. So it's Truman Taft Benson. And I like to say it's the best of both political parties with that name. So, he's a good boy. He's a lot of fun. Tatum is our dancer. She's really kind of found her place here in Myrtle Beach. And then Talmadge, our 13-year-old, is out on the golf course right now. And when we're done, I'll go join him for a quick 9 holes. So they've taken to life in South Carolina. And this part, Melissa, we've asked a lot of our kids. You know, my wife grew up in the same house, Olympus High grad, never moved. I went to 5 different elementary schools in 6 years. So we were moving all over the place. And we've asked a lot of our children. I mean, we moved here. They were very happily ensconced there in Kentucky. And I think that's an important lesson to be adaptable and be able to get along with people and appreciate differences. Because it's a very different atmosphere here. They're the only LDS kids in their school. And that's taught them quite a bit too.
So Ezra Taft Benson, your grandfather, had how many kids did he have?
He had 6. So he had 2 sons. My dad was the 2nd son. So Reed taught at BYU. My dad went to BYU, then went to Stanford, got a master's degree in education. He really wanted to be a high school principal and recognized that was a heavy lift. So while he was at Stanford, he started selling cookware door to door to kind of support my mom and my brother. And he found his calling in life with sales. So he worked his way into owning his own company. They produced cookware and stoneware in China and cutlery and that sort of thing. And then four girls after that. So same number of kids in our family.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that when your name ends in Taft Benson, there's some benefits that come with that. And there's some challenges that come with that. Let's start with the challenges. What are the challenges that come with having your name be Taft Benson?
Well, I think I sensed it for the first time, not the first time, but really in Texas, nobody really cared. I mean, we moved to Utah when I was a sophomore in high school. So I land in East High, and you know, my grandpa would come to our church once in a while when we lived up in the Avenues, the Ensign First Ward. And, you know, it was a really big deal. He, at the time, he was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve. So he spoke at my farewell as the president of the Quorum of the Twelve. And then when I came home, he was president of the church. So here the chapel was absolutely chock full of people. And I, oh man, so many people are here to hear me. And I thought, no, they're not. Yeah, they're here to hear my grandpa. And he was a wonderful man. I mean, just as a grandfather, that's how I thought of him. I didn't really think of him as anything else. Now that I look back on the Sunday dinners when he would come when I was at BYU my freshman year or when I was in high school, I really wish I had taken the time to ask him about his life more. You know, I was so consumed with what I was doing. He'd always ask me if I was behaving myself. So every week I know I'd get that check-in on Sundays and I better not mess up. But, you know, he just was first and foremost, he loved his family. And he wrote me every month on my mission. I kept those letters. That was being a great deal to me. And, you know, when we moved out to South Carolina, again, no one knows really who I am or our family lineage. But when I was on my mission, my sister Meg served in the same mission and came home about a year before I left.
What mission was it?
It was in Rome, Italy.
So oh, okay.
Everywhere I went, I was always known as Meg's little brother. Just like at BYU in the political science department, I was always known as Steve's little brother. So I really tried to live up to, of course, the family name and the history of it, but also be my own person. I mean, that's we're put on this earth with our agency. And, you know, my brother's chosen a different path in life that was very well publicized. And we love him. He's our brother. And that's the beauty of the gospel. I mean, you make your own choices and live with the consequences of those choices.
Yeah. Well, and you said your parents were kind of strict growing up. Were they strict religiously or just in general?
Yes and yes. I mean, you know, curfews. I don't remember. I probably had my first Coca-Cola when I was away on a trip somewhere with friends. I mean, it was, and you know, we would, you know, the requirement of wearing a shirt and tie to sit and listen to conference on the radio. I remember when they used to have conference, it was 3 days. It would be on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And we would go to our church in Richardson, Texas. And my mom would pull me out of school for that. And so, and there were expectations. I mean, everybody knew that I was going to go to BYU. I had an offer to run the 800 meters. I was a runner in high school at the University of Utah. And my parents said, nope, you're going to BYU. And here's your schedule. My sister Meg had done it. And I thought, I look at the schedule and it's got biology, chemistry, English, Book of Mormon. I said, where are the fun classes, Meg? And, you know, I learned in a hurry that college was hard. That's what it's supposed to be. So, they were strict, but they were also, they were fun. My parents were a lot of fun.
Well, do you think they felt pressure as part of, you know, raising the Benson generation, the next generation to be that way, to parent that way?
I don't know if they felt pressure as much as they did a kind of a sense of obligation, maybe a sense of duty. There was always very high expectations because, you know, we knew that my grandfather was a very exacting, you know, he had this, I think maybe a countenance that people thought was stern and maybe a little, overbearing or strict. But as I said, he was very, very loving, but he also expected a lot of us. Our family reunions were not, you know, I never went to Disneyland until I took my kids a few years ago. And we went to Nauvoo for a family reunion. We went to Independence, Missouri one time. We'd go up to Canada. It seems like a lot of our family gatherings were around church events. And that was just the way it was. And we didn't know any different.
So a lot of our listeners have never met a general authority, have never interacted with a general authority. And most of the way they see general authorities is through talks that they give at general conference. And there's sort of this impression of like, that's who they are. And I get the sense from you, that's not at all who they are. That's just something that they do every 6 months or something like that. What is it like, you know, having your grandfather be a general authority or a leader in the church? And then maybe having people quote to you what he says to you all the time, right? And you're like, what is, kind of give our listeners a sense of what that's like.
It's not unusual when you go to Elder's Quorum or someone in church said, you know, that I want to refer to the talk on pride or the talk to mothers or the talk to the youth that my grandfather, I think, was well known for, or on the Book of Mormon. I mean, everybody knows him as, and you know, every president of the church kind of has his own, if you will, I don't want to say principle, but cause that they really, or object lesson that they really press. You know, President Kimball, I remember, was always lengthen your stride. You know, with my grandfather, it was a lot about the Book of Mormon. You know, President Hinckley was a lot about temples. And President Hunter, even though it was a short period of time, he was just about, you know, being kind to people. I had a chance to interact a few times with him when I was in Israel. He came and dedicated the Jerusalem Center when we were there as students. And just was so impressed with how kind and gentle he was. And the same can be said for a lot of the general authorities I had the opportunity to meet and to get to know. But, you know, you always try and, you know, Joseph Smith said a prophet is a prophet only when he is a prophet. So, you know, that's not just word salad. I think there's a principle there that there are moments when he has that obligation, that responsibility, that mantle, if you will. But the other times he's a human being with foibles and faults and families and still has those obligations. And that's how we thought of him.
You didn't feel like you were maybe questioning your testimony or being apostate if you said something kind of mean about your dad or your grandpa, if he was mean to you. You're like, hey, like being a disobedient grandchild, you didn't feel like you were somehow doing something mean to Jesus or something like that?
No, my grandfather, see, he passed away in 1994. And I was writing my dissertation on Harry Truman, who, of course, was a Democrat. My grandfather was as Republican as you can get. And so it took a little while for the family to warm the idea that I was writing about Harry Truman. And we had kind of very good back and forth with my aunt and uncle, my aunts and uncle, rather, about it. You know, I used to give a talk at BYU Education Week about Truman and the founding of the State of Israel. That's what I wrote about. Truman is kind of a modern-day Cyrus. And, you know, when they would hear me tell these stories about Harry Truman, not that they would flinch. I think they finally accepted the fact that I did that, and I really enjoyed it. But, you know, we had, like every family, we had our differences. But there was a certain expectation of how we would behave, and that was, you know, that was it. So
it was okay if you admired his political opponents.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Hey, so that does remind me, because you wrote that biography on the founder of Johns Hopkins University. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about writing a biography of your grandfather or your great-grandfather?
No. Obviously, Sherry Dew did one. I've got it right off my right shoulder here. He wrote his own autobiography called Crossfire, which was really focused on the Eisenhower years. You know, he was all 8 years as cabinet secretary. By the way, I meet people in Washington, D.C. who remember him from his time there. I was in D.C. 10 days ago, and we work with a law firm that has an office right there on Constitution Avenue. And you look out their window, and there is the Robert Taft Memorial right there on Capitol Hill. And Robert Taft was my grandfather's second or third cousin. So when Eisenhower called him to invite him to be his Secretary of Agriculture, kind of the clincher at the end when he told me he couldn't do it for several reasons, he said, "Mr. President-elect, I'm sorry, but I did not vote for you." And I voted for my cousin. So you know, that just kind of goes to show that there's a lot that kind of the name carries a little bit of heft and a little bit of weight. But over time, you just kind of learn to live with that.
So let's talk about being a university president. That's a big career, and it seems like you've done it in a couple of different places. How long did you teach? Did you teach Middle Eastern studies before you got into administration, or no?
No, I've never been a full-time faculty member. Okay. I've had faculty appointments everywhere I've gone, but I have a full professorship here at the university, and I teach a class every year. So either fall or spring semester. I just did one on a seminar on World War I. But I really think it's important to kind of stay in the classroom, even as an administrator. So my friend Gordon Gee, Latter-day Saint out of Vernal, Utah, is at West Virginia for a second time. He's been president of more places than I have. But when I got my job at Snow College at 36, I knew he was made president of West Virginia when he was 36. So I called him one day. I said, Gordon, what advice would you have for me as a 36-year-old? He says, very simple, Michael. No one should ever make a 36-year-old president of anything. So, you know, I
good advice. About, really good advice. Thank you.
I thought about learning on the job. And I have. I've had four different presidencies now in three states, Utah, Kentucky, and South Carolina. And, you know, it's fun because not too many people know about the LDS faith or our belief system here. This is, as they say, Baptists are thick on the ground in South Carolina. And, you know, my kids interacted a lot with the youth in the high school and the Presbyterian church. And they bring kids to church periodically from other faiths. And it's wonderful to be back in the mission field because you never take for granted how important it is to really live what you believe. And you know, not to do it in your face sort of way, but just in a calm, this is what I believe and this is why I believe, and you commit to it.
So this is related to your work as a university president, but also just as an individual, how do you think the youth in the church today are different from the youth maybe when you were growing up?
Well, I think they're just bombarded with so many more things, distractions, even temptations. I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like growing up with a cell phone in my back pocket and having access to all the stuff that they have, which is a blessing and a curse. I mean, I see all the innovation that's happened with learning and how my kids are so adept at getting on a computer and using Google Word and being able to do all these, you know, Google Docs and be able to do all these things that, you know, it wasn't until I took a typing class in high school that I knew how to do the,
on a typewriter, by the way.
On a typewriter. No, yes. Exactly. So a lot is expected of them, and not that a lot wasn't expected of our generation, but I have enormous respect for kids that, you know, my kids look forward to for the Strength of Youth every summer. They do it up at Wilmington, UNC Wilmington up the road, and they get to hang out with kids that believe the same thing they do. You know, everybody knows that our kids are Mormons and they don't do certain things, and we do certain things like go to church on Sundays and that sort of thing. And it makes them kind of put a little more kind of a stiffness in their backbone, as it were, because you have to be on alert all the time. And, you know, growing up in Utah, when you're surrounded by Latter-day Saints, it was a little different. So I'm grateful for the opportunity my kids are having out here.
So you've probably noticed that the church is putting a lot of money into higher education, to BYU Pathway. And but you have experience at these other schools with a lot of LDS kids that are not church schools. What's the advantage for a kid choosing a place like Snow College or Southern Utah University as opposed to like a church school?
In fact, I gave a talk at the Mormon Historical Society, or Association rather. It was down at the St. George Tabernacle, on the history of higher education in Utah, and not only Utah, but Idaho and Arizona, and how the church in many ways west of the Mississippi, short of what was happening in California in, let's say, the 1850s when it became a state, and they founded the University of California in 1868, I believe it was. The church did more to establish what they called stake academies than any other organization. And they did it in Rexburg. They did it in Ogden, Utah. They did it in Salt Lake City. You know, the San Pete Stake Academy was the precursor to Snow College. You know, the Weber Stake Academy, what we had down in Southern Utah, although it wasn't a church institution, was founded by church members in 1897, you know, down at Dixie State. So, and then what did the church do in the 1920s? They basically gave all the institutions to the states where they were located. Yeah. And the only reason they kept Ricks around, I don't think Idaho could afford to take on a college, so they kept it.
Yeah, I read that story. We offered Ricks College to the state of Idaho for $1, and they turned us down.
Yeah,
so we had to keep Ricks.
They didn't want to have to pay them the M&O, I guess, to keep it going. But, you know, and even in Arizona, I think it's Eastern Arizona College there in Snowflake or Thatcher someplace. Same thing. It was a stake academy. And so the church should be very proud of the fact that, particularly in the West, and by the way, I talked about the Pacific Islands and out in Hawaii. You know, we went with our football team for our bowl game in Hawaii, and I took three members of our board of trustees up to see the temple in Laie, and they were just absolutely bowled over. They told me one of the highlights of the trip was going and meeting the sister missionaries. and seeing how beautiful that place was. And we met with the president of the University of Hawaii, BYU Hawaii, and he was fantastic. So I think it's, you know, kids today, I tell parents all the time, you know, their money is portable. And if they show up on your doorstep and you don't have what the student wants, they're going to go elsewhere. So you have to find that right spot for you. And whether it's a church school, whether it's a state school that has a strong institute program, or whether it's a school like Coastal Carolina, where we have probably two Latter-day Saints among almost 11,000 students. But everybody knows I'm a Mormon. Everybody knows I'm LDS, and they know that I don't drink. So I guess that's one of the few people out here that does not.
They figured out really quickly.
Yeah.
Well, so I wonder, since you have had so much experience with the church, both inside of Utah and outside of Utah, what's something that people who've maybe never experienced church outside of Utah should know about the church?
The people outside the state of Utah?
I'll ask you about both. But yeah, if you've only ever experienced church in Utah, what should those people know about the church?
Oh, okay. Well, I saw this much more in Texas when we had, youth activities during the week. And then we had those two blocks, you know, you'd show up for priesthood meeting and Relief Society in the morning, then you go home for lunch and then come back in the afternoon for sacrament meeting, where the church was much more of a gathering point for youth. Not that it's not now in places like Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, but the church has really kind of pivoted and said, we want that activity to happen in the home. Mm-hmm. And, we'll try and consolidate and do things on a limited basis so you can be home, and a lot of that teaching can happen in the home. But, you know, growing up, I remember some of my best friends were the ones that were in our ward. You know, I was just honored by the scout troop here for my activity with scouting. And now, quite honestly, I'm a little disappointed to not see the scouting program like I knew it. I'm not going to pine for the good old days, but it just isn't what it used to be. That's my brother went to Philmont, and I went to scout camp every year. My Eagle Project was tied to a ward activity, all those sorts of things. So it's very different. Not to say one better than the other. But
I hadn't thought about that, how this church-supported, home-centered church really affects the sense of community in these places. Because when I lived in Kansas, it's true, I had a home teaching assignment that was a 50-minute drive, and that was a challenge, and it was difficult to do. But at the same time, the church is where we saw each other, because that's where everybody could come. And so that would be different.
Yeah, it is. And our ward is not far from here. And we found a real home in our ward when we got here. And then it got so big, they split it. And a lot of the people that we really got close to in our first 18 months, 2 years, are now in the other ward. So I'm just happy to say I kept my calling, which is I'm the pianist in the primary, which is the best calling in the church.
Yeah.
Those kids say the funniest things.
Well, so what about the other side? What is it people in Utah should know about the church? That's what I just asked you. Well, the people outside of Utah, what should they know about the Utah church?
Oh, the Utah church. Well, I'll tell you a quick story. I got to know one of our assistant coaches here at Coastal we took him to lunch one time on a Sunday after church and invited him to come to church with us. A single guy who had been in Louisville. He's a native of Louisville, Kentucky, had kind of bounced around different places. But he left Coastal and went to Tarleton State in Texas. And out of the blue, he got to know my son, Sam, because Sam comes to the Coastal as much as he can because he loves being on campus and being by the ocean. But he had texted Sam and told him, he said, I haven't told your dad yet, but I started taking the missionary discussions.
Huh.
And lo and behold, he texted me back and he told me he was getting baptized on January the 6th this year. He's now assistant coach at New Mexico State University. And I surprised him. I didn't tell him I was coming out. Sam reached out to the missionaries and I showed up at his baptism. And it was one of the most memorable experiences I'll ever have, because I saw kind of the trajectory that Zach was on in his own life. And I talked to him yesterday. We talk all the time, but he's going out to the Final Four, which is in Phoenix this year. And then he's skipping out early so he can go to conference on Sunday afternoon. And, the reason I tell you that story is you never know when someone is introduced to the church here, the draw there is to see what it's like in Utah, because it's so foreign in terms of you know, a church on every corner. I can drive down the street here in South Carolina and see a Presbyterian church, a Baptist church, an AME Baptist church, a Catholic church on just about every corner. Out there, they're everywhere. And that's very foreign to them. So he's really excited about meeting a whole bunch of Latter-day Saints, but also going to conference. So, you know, both places are different, very different, and each has its strengths and, I think, drawback.
Yeah. Well, and you talked about the trajectory of him. Do you ever think about your life trajectory? Because it seems like you've had so many choices and so many opportunities. Do you think that being a member of the church, being a faithful member of the church, was an important part of that trajectory? Do you think you'd be somewhere else without it? What do you think?
That's, you always kind of, I just turned 59 and you kind of look back and think, what if I had had this, that fulcrum moment, chosen a different path? You know, when I was in grad school, I was the only Latter-day Saint. I was made the young men's president. I played the organ in the Oxford branch. I met a rabbi friend by the name of Shmuley Boteach, a Lubavitcher rabbi. He was the first Lubavitcher Jew that I got to know. I was the first Latter-day Saint. He has since come out. He's brought Elie Wiesel to Snow College when I was president there. Hmm. He's come to Utah and stayed with us. He came and spoke at Coastal Carolina. He's one of my best friends. And who would have thought that, you know, if I had chosen maybe to not pursue a Latter-day Saint path while I was at Oxford and maybe just assimilate and do what everybody else was doing, I never would have gotten to know Shmuley. And his life has so enriched mine. And I hope I've done the same for him. But that's one example. I mean, I played basketball at Oxford and my teammates were like Cory Booker, the U.S. Senator in New Jersey, and Jonah White Edelman, and a bunch of Rhodes Scholars. I was a Rotary Scholar, so I joke, if I say it fast, it sounds like I was a Rhodes Scholar.
That's what I hear. Yeah, I hear.
You know, listen.
You know, that was a great way for me to introduce a lot of people from all over the world, really smart people that had never met a Latter-day Saint. So, I mean, Melissa, that's a very good question, because I think, you know, maybe – hopefully I did have an influence in their perception of Latter-day Saints for good. But if I hadn't done that, then who's to say? I mean, maybe they wouldn't have ever been introduced to our church through that kind of association.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up something else that Matt often talks about, which is one of the reasons to pick which college you're going to go to pick which career you're going to take. I mean, a lot of times you can look at colleges and they're all kind of, you know, similar or have similar things to offer. But Matt always tells, you know, kids that age, like, it's all about the connections that you're going to make where you're going to be. Yeah. And so obviously, like, that's part of the prayerful decision that you should be making. But often it's really important to just be in the right place to meet the people you need to meet.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And as I said, students have to decide what is the right fit for them. Mm-hmm. And for some kids, you know, growing up in Arizona, for example, that are from Mesa, and they really want to go to BYU or they want to go to BYU Idaho, maybe getting part of, you know, being involved in the institute program at Arizona State is where they're supposed to be. And you never know. You're exactly right. I made friends in college at all the places where I've gone that are friends for life. I mentioned Shmuley. I mentioned one of my friends from Notre Dame, Ryan Heatherman. We're like this. And it was he's a very devout Catholic. I'm a very devout Mormon. And we used to have a lot of conversations about the similarities and the dissimilarities of our faith with this mutual respect for each other and really a love for the fact that we found our path and we respected each other's path.
So related to higher education, you might have heard this story about the University of Utah women's basketball team and what happened in Idaho and the racism. And the team there, they said something along the lines of they're not used to experiencing that kind of racism because there's so much diversity on a college campus. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's something to that? Do you think there's something about college that maybe teaches people a better way of thinking than racism?
Well, that's a really good question and a good point. I've been giving a lot of talks lately. I spoke at the inauguration of our provost, who's now the president of Delta State, which is a university in Cleveland, Mississippi. And in my talk, I was the keynote, and I quoted, as I called him, religious leader and renowned heart surgeon, Russell M. Nelson. Huh. And, you know, nobody in there. There was one elder, I know, Latter-day Saint, his name's Tommy Duff. He's on the board for the universities in Mississippi. And the quote is, that, and Elder Nelson gave this in a talk years ago, and I've used it time and again. He took the word university, and if you take the stem, the preface of the stem, uni to turn, or one, verse to turn, so to turn to one. And he mentioned the fact that in every major European language, there's only one word where only the stem and the prefix, that was the word, are the same. And the ending's only different. And that word is university. And his point is that, you know, we're very different. We all come to our beliefs from a different path. But a university is a place where we're all turned to one in the pursuit, you know, the acquisition, the application of knowledge. And that really binds us together in a way that I don't think there's many other entities or institutions in our society that bring different people together on a campus like a university does. So we could be, you know, miles apart in terms of our religious or our political views or our orientations. But if you're at a university and you're there to study and to do the best that you can with those opportunities, it really does break down a lot of those barriers that you see out in society. And I tell students all the time, if you can't have difficult debates on a university campus and come away still friends, but maybe disagreeing on some really fundamental principles, then you can't have those conversations anywhere, because that's what a university is all about.
Yeah. But Melissa's very concerned about artificial intelligence and what that's going to do.
No, not concerned. I'm excited about artificial intelligence.
And yeah, what it's going to do for universities?
Have you played around with it much? Have you noticed how much it's going to change education?
I have. And we have a faculty member at the university that is on top of it. I mean, he posts stuff. We have a website where he is always posting resources, you know, how students can use it, but how they can properly attribute the source in papers and that sort of thing. So I'm kind of with you. The unknown kind of worries me. This came up the other day. I just came from a conference in Boston, and the point was made, you know, you could take AI now and create, you know, false political ads that you can use with, you know, robo dials, and people can hear a voice. It's completely contrived, fake sort of call. I mean, that sort of thing. Now, it's not that sophisticated, but what they're contemplating now with AI is going to completely change the way students learn and how they utilize it for their benefit. So I'm with you. There's a lot we don't know, but there's a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm super excited about the future of education. And I'm a high school teacher, and mm-hmm. I think my frustration is right now is that every tool that's available as our district quickly blocks because they're afraid that students are going to use it inappropriately. And certainly there's ways to do that, but I'm like, let's just teach them how to just move this into a completely higher level of learning. Instead of starting at a lower point, we can start at a much higher point, and then from there we can expand our overall education. And so it excites me. And yeah, I'm glad to hear that that you're on the same page as me. Matt, how do you feel now?
Well, maybe just to pivot to your book a little bit, Mike, about Johns Hopkins University and how that revolutionized higher education. Mm-hmm. Do you think that higher education now is at a point where there could be another sort of next step or a next kind of innovation like that, where the university changes in maybe important and dramatic ways that universities today in the United States could be at the forefront of that step again, or not?
Well, the gentleman I wrote about, his name was Daniel Coit Gilman. He was born in Norwich, Connecticut. He was a geographer who studied at Yale. By the way, when he was the third president of the University of California before he became the first president of Johns Hopkins. And on his train trip out to Berkeley, he stopped in Salt Lake City and spent time with Brigham Young to talk about this University of Deseret that they had founded, you know, 15 years
interesting.
Earlier.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, and I called the church history to see if there was any sort of record, because Gilman recorded in his diary. That's how I found out about it. But there's no notation in any sort of diary. But you know, he was that kind of person. He wanted to learn as much as he could from as many people as he could. And so he created this research university. And one of his famous quotes was that every epoch of time requires kind of a fresh approach, a fresh kind of take on things. Because universities, as you know, are very traditional. And we tend to get very kind of staid and stale. And unless you are ready to kind of recharge and say, you know, this is the new university, ready for the 21st century. And the research university that they created in Baltimore had never been tried before excuse me, in the sense that it was the German emphasis on primary research coupled with the British emphasis on the tutorial method, you know, and bringing them together and create this this unbelievably powerful entity that, by the way, spawned other private schools that you all recognize. Vanderbilt University. So Hopkins gave his gift in 1869. Vanderbilt was established in 1872. After that, Clark University, which is an all-graduate school in Massachusetts. The Rockefellers founded the University of Chicago. And the Stanfords founded Stanford out in California. So it spawned this tremendous growth of, yes, public institutions, but also private institutions that today impact us in ways we just don't understand. Y'all remember during COVID, there was that ticker at the bottom of CNN or Fox or whatever, wherever you got your news. It was the COVID dashboard that was provided by which university? Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah.
And they last year they did $3.4 billion in sponsored research. So wow. When you talk about AI, you talk about the advancements in technology, in medicine, in biotechnology. Those are coming out of where? They're coming off of campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have these remarkably smart faculty who then engage students, who then try and take that research and apply it for the betterment of society. So I think universities have a pivotal role to play now and in the future, just like they have. And you know, the American system of education is the envy of the world. You think about how many people are beating down the doors to come to our universities for undergrad, but particularly our graduate programs.
Right.
And so that, you know, we have a lot of faults as a country, but I would argue that our higher ed system is not one of them.
Yeah. So I just sometimes I wonder about that because I can see that the church is trying to globalize, right? Education, university education. And I just sometimes wonder, like, do we have the same kind of talent invested in this idea of educating the world as we do in research and development? And I don't know the answer to that. I just think like maybe AI presents some opportunities that, I don't know, like maybe things could really explode in a different way than they did in the past.
Well, one thing that really impressed me about our visit to BYU Hawaii when we met with the president was he told us all about their students from Asia and from the Pacific Isles that had no hope whatsoever of ever going to college.
Right.
And the church provided this amazing chance at BYU Hawaii and that they will then go back to their home country, and hopefully this ripple effect, they'll impact all their folks from their villages or their hometowns or their cities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
without changing their cultures too,
yeah,
right? Like
exactly.
They're able to keep their culture, but add this education component.
Yeah.
It really is beautiful.
I just finished Masters of the Air. I'm a big World War II buff. And at the end of the documentary about Masters of the Air, it listed the pilots that they talked about. And to a person, every one of them took advantage of the GI Bill.
Hmm.
And changed their life. You know, you had one that became a professor at Harvard, one taught at Stanford, you know, one became an attorney and actually tried people at the trials in Germany. And, you know, you think about how that changed access to education for an entire generation. And I often ask the groups I speak to, how many of you had a family member that either back in the 1940s or today have availed themselves of the GI Bill? And 75% of the hands go up.
Yeah.
Think about how that public policy has changed our country.
Yeah. Well, Mike, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thanks so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to say before we end?
Now, what's with the Alaska flag in the background there, Matt? What's that
Thank
all about?
Thank you. Excellent question. Thank you.
Okay. So full disclosure, this right here is a map of Ukraine. I served my mission in Donetsk that's under attack right now. So
okay.
Right here where this Alaska flag is, I used to have a flag of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. So it had the hammer and sickle, and it had the blue and the red.
Uh-huh.
And then when Russia invaded Ukraine, I was like, I can't hang that up anymore. I was kind of salty with Russia. So I had to find another flag. People also don't know this. I've got a little bust of Lenin that I keep in my So I have a lot of Soviet propaganda that I keep around. But the flag I had to switch, and I thought, what's a better flag than the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic? It's the flag of Alaska.
Well, so. I'll track down your address. I'm going to send you a South Carolina flag. Because
okay, that is, yes.
It's that's
one
a great
of those flags around. And there's a story to it. There was a Moultrie, a general during the Revolutionary War, who Fort Moultrie, he put the palmetto leaves of the palmetto tree, which is our state tree, at the base of this fort. And when the British cannonballs hit these very spongy leaves of the tree, they would ricochet off and they would not harm it at all. So people think that's the crescent moon. But if you look at Revolutionary War uniforms, there was this kind of accoutrement that they would wear, this little piece of silver at the top of their uniform that would look like a moon. So our flag is that, the palmetto tree with the moon, and it has a lot of significance. So
okay, yeah, that is a good.
If you send that to me, I will replace that flag.
Okay, all right. I want to see that. I'll put one in the mail.
That sounds great. Hey, well, thank you so much for joining us. Listener, join us again next week.